This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So, hello everyone, welcome back to New Books Network. This is Shuang, your host. Today I feel very happy to invite Dr. Liu to join us to talk about his newest book, Forever Struggle. It's a fantastic book about Chinese Bostonian history, especially in the 20th century. So, first thing I want to do today is to invite Dr. Liu to introduce himself to us.
Okay, I'm a 70-something native Bostonian. I was born in Chinatown, and I spent my adult life as a community and social justice activist, primarily in Boston, but with a couple of years in New York City. And in my later year, I became a researcher studying Asian Americans at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Other than the book that we're talking about today, I also co-wrote a book about Asian American activism.
Okay, thanks so much for your answer. So I think it's interesting that you mentioned you are a native Bostonian. So for this, for my next question is that I'm wondering why you take interest in studying the history of your community and your city.
Well, obviously, being born in Boston Chinatown, I'm interested in the neighborhood. But there were a couple of main reasons. From my life activities, I saw the impact that Chinatown had on the course of the city over time. But that was an influence that was really documented or acknowledged. And I think this was part of the image that I inherited from mainstream society, that Chinese Americans were always a passive population that contributed little to the social and civic life of U.S. society in general. So this book was an attempt to document how Chinese Americans were involved in the flow of the city's history, but also how their activities that helped at times to change the course of that flow. Second reason is that for me, like, Chinatown's long-term prospects in Boston are uncertain, and I wanted a record of what I think is a remarkable community to be documented.
Thanks so much for answering it. So now let's turn to your book. For the first question, I want to invite you to talk about the settlement of Chinatown on the margin of changing Boston, Boston's history, and its evolution from refuge to a viable community with local economy and organizational infrastructure.
Thank you for the question. So the establishment of Boston Chinatown was part of a larger pattern of establishing Chinese settlements in the eastern United States. Chinese had first migrated to the West Coast in the mid-19th century and worked in mining, fishing, construction, and also in looking for gold, which had been discovered in California. But perhaps best known of all the work that Chinese did was the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, which basically united the continental United States. But you have to remember that in the mid-19th century, this was an era of global imperialism, colonialism and consequently racism. Remember, I mean, the century of the Opium Wars, you know, and colonization of places like, Puerto Rico and Hawaii by the United States and so on. So Chinese, when they first came, was always discriminated against and maltreated. But, you know, they survived. But by the late 19th century, violence and murder in the Western United States forced Chinese to seek other places to settle. For just an example, during this time, over 200 California cities and towns forced Chinese from their municipal borders. And these were accompanied by hangings, shootings, and arson. So Chinese went east on the transcontinental railroad network that they had helped build and settled in many eastern United States cities, such as Chicago, Columbus, Ohio, Hartford, Providence, and Baltimore. I don't know if they settled anywhere near Buffalo, though. So the first acknowledgement of a Boston settlement that I found was in an 1880 Boston Globe is the primary newspaper in Boston, well, today anyway. And it spoke of a quote, Chinese quarter on Harrison Avenue. So this was a semi-industrial transportation area that was built on landfill in Boston. In fact, you know, Boston has a lot of land that was created by filling in the bays around the city. But it was considered very undesirable and was mostly populated by immigrants. When the East Coast Eastern United States Chinese came, they tried different lines of work that were not, because of the experience, they wanted work that was not competitive with white male labor, because they had driven them out of all the occupations that I mentioned earlier. And also Massachusetts state law also barred Chinese from numerous occupations, particularly government and professional jobs. So these Chinese laborers finally hit upon hand laundry work, because that was commonly seen as quote unquote woman's work. But of course, laundries could not concentrate in just one neighborhood. But Boston had pioneered a streetcar system and had built an extensive railroad network in New England. And so that allowed Chinese to disperse all over New England to open up hand laundries. But while the Chinese could open up shops in these cities and towns, they couldn't actually live there. So they had to sleep in their shops, and they lived frugal, grueling, and isolated lives while they were, you know, in their shops. So for social and cultural activities, and for personal services like translation and taking a bath, you know, running water was not that common at the time. They traveled back to Boston Chinatown when their work week was done. And so businesses were designed to serve the dispersed population. So businesses such as restaurants and laundries arose. And that's how Chinatown became a center for each area's Chinese population. However, around the turn of the century, the economic basis of the community changed, and it shifted because, you know, the invention of the washing machine undermined the hand laundry industry. And the general population had also become more accustomed to Chinese food. So more of the Chinese population opened or began working in restaurants. So that's sort of how the community evolved. But a couple of important things to point out is that the antagonism toward Chinese that I talked about earlier culminated finally in 1882 in the Chinese Exclusion Act. So this federal legislation was directed particularly excluding Chinese laborers but also emphasizing excluding Chinese women from immigrating to the United States, because the intention was to prevent Chinese families at all costs from forming in the United States. So what resulted in Chinatowns were quote-unquote bachelor societies, communities of working-age males. Some of them had wives back in China, but, you know, for the most part, they were, it was just men around in the Chinatowns. The second thing that's important to know is that the Chinese and the U.S. form many organizations, you know, based upon kinship or geography from where they came from, and political brotherhoods. So they were from a very specific area of China near Hong Kong, and so they had ties with one another. So this network of organization was both an important source of internal community conflict between different groups, but more importantly, it was a means of self-defense, and it was a type of community infrastructure. So they helped to regulate the community. For example, they prevented competition between individual laundries by kind of saying that you can set up a laundry in this town, but it has to be so many streets away from this other laundry, and also for settling disputes. And they also provided some basic services. But yeah, so that's how, you know, the Chinatown community developed.
Okay, thanks so much for your answer. I very appreciate your discussion, your introduction of both the evolution and the expansion of Chinatown in Boston. So for a second question, I want to invite you to talk about the change that happened in Boston and Chinatown in the four decades after World War II, especially during Mayor Ken White's administration.
Okay, so in the post-World War II period, so we're talking about the late 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, both Boston and Chinatown changed significantly. China and the United States were allies in the war, and the United States eventually repealed the Chinese Exclusion Act. However, the quota that replaced it was quite restrictive. I think it was about 100 Chinese that were allowed per year. But there were other loopholes, like the Foreign Brides Act. So a number of Chinese American soldiers were allowed to bring over brides from China. My father was a veteran, and that's how my mother came over as a foreign war bride. And in 1965, the immigration system was overhauled, and that led to a sudden jump in Chinese as well as other Asian immigration. So the Chinese American population increasingly changed from the Chinese American community changed from a male society to more of a family based one. The Chinese population also diversified, just rather than just being from one small area of China, Chinese from Hong Kong, Taiwan, and other areas immigrated to the United States. So this weakened the traditional community infrastructure of those organizations based upon geography and kinship. And after the increased flow of immigrants in 1965, this old infrastructure was unable to meet the needs of the population. For example, none of the groups that I mentioned had organized, they did things like organizing English language classes, you know, or provide services around education issues, or health issues, and so on. So what happened instead was that by this time in the 60s, there had been a larger number of American-born Chinese. So that generation, and also immigrant students saw the need in the community, and they began to develop new organizations and a competing community infrastructure. these groups were either modeled after mainstream organizations or they were inspired by the civil rights and Black Power movements that were prevailed in the late 60s and 1970s. So in general, these groups provided new services. They were had a more confrontational attitude and they toward the power structure, and they sought and they tried to claim resources from the power structure, saying, you know, we need this, we need that, and we want you to provide it. But antagonism had toward Chinese had declined even before this change had happened. You know, the Japanese invasion of China had created a lot of sympathy for Chinese and by extension Chinese Americans before the war. And discrimination areas like housing and education had declined sharply. However, when the communists achieved power in China in 1949, suspicion and harassment of suspected sympathizers in the Chinese community became a new force and created a lot of problems for the community. At the same time, Boston as a city was trying to reinvent itself because it had had a long period of decline before the war. The war helped it a little bit, but it was not able to sustain it. And for many decades, the Irish-American community, there were a lot of Irish immigrants that came slightly before and after the Chinese came to Boston, had been in a decades-long battle with the Anglo-Saxon Protestant community. And the Irish had won, Irish Americans had won political control of the city in the middle 19th century. But the Anglo-Saxon Protestants still controlled the state government and businesses in Boston, and they fought intense battles with one another. However, after the war, they united in trying to revive and transform the city. So the two tools that they availed themselves of were federal programs. One was urban renewal funds, and the other was federal interstate highway funds in the 1950s and 60s. But both initiatives targeted the more powerless and poorer neighborhoods, such as African-American neighborhoods. But Chinatowns were no exception. So this is a period when many of the eastern United States Chinatowns were wiped out. So Mayor Kevin White, who came to power in the 1970s, kind of represented these forces that were trying to change Boston. And he had tried to make a big attempt to make Boston a quote-unquote world-class city by redeveloping the city.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point-of-sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Thanks so much for your answer. For the next question, that I'm all wondering, while you talk about Chinese Bostonian community, active struggle for both social and housing justice?
Both urban renewal and new highways impacted Boston Chinatown. So one aspect of rebuilding Boston was emphasizing institutions that would attract new and upper class residents. So that included hospitals, and Tufts New England Medical Center was on the western side of Chinatown. So a 1965 urban renewal plan was passed for the area that envisioned the elimination of the residential area of Chinatown in order to give the land to the New England Medical Center. Chinatown was also adjacent to the downtown business area where urban renewal was focused. So in addition, new highways were also needed to accommodate new suburban populations that were developed after World War II and that who was supposed to come in and work in the city. But in order to do that, they needed highways. So as a poor working class area, Boston, Chinatown was a natural target. So first, the Central Artery, which eventually became a part of Interstate 93, and then the Massachusetts Turnpike extension took large chunks out of the eastern side of Chinatown. So about one third of the community was lost. So Chinatown, as a result, was cut off by highways on the eastern side and on the south, and Tustin-Winkle Medical Center and the business district was expanding on the western side and on the north of Chinatown. And besides taking Chinatown land, the city's attitude toward the community was shown by its actions in 1974 when the city's only adult entertainment district was zoned next to the neighborhood. So in most cities, probably in Buffalo, there isn't that type of zoning. Like, you will see, you know, pornography shops all over the city. But Boston decided to zone into one area. And they concentrated that area next to Chinatown. So they highly recognized that there was a family community there. So the traditional community infrastructure that was dominant at the time in the community was unable to respond. And the new organizations were still too new and small to organize much resistance. So there were some small attempts, but the new groups learned from this period of history that the city's promises of benefits to the neighborhood were illusory and not true. However, in 1975, a potential new base of resistance revealed itself around the issue of school desegregation. So in this case, Chinese immigrant parents, also almost exclusively women, supported by some of these young American-born activists, organized the community to boycott Boston Public Schools over safety, representation, and language issues. Because the courts, the school system, and the Boston School Committee had ignored any groups other than the Black community and the white community over the issue of school desegregation, the Chinese community and the Latin community had many issues about busing. But those entities ignored the issues even after the Chinese parents started to organize over the late spring and summer. None of the issues were addressed. And so they organized a multi-day walkout and even defied the Federal Department of Justice and the traditional community infrastructure, which told the parents they couldn't go against the courts and the city. But in the end, the institutions met nearly all the demands. So through this issue and the organizing the parents, the neighborhood made its presence known as an active community in the city to other neighborhoods and to Boston institutions, perhaps for the first time. And so that's sort of how activism in the community began.
And so much for your answer. I want to say a little bit. When I read this book, the session about Chinese Bostonian community active struggle for the social justice, actually is between chapter 4 to chapter 8. This part is my favorite part because from my perspective as a historian, even for a general listeners here, we know when we talk about urban renewal, when we talk about gentrification in those big cities like Detroit, like New York, even Buffalo, we always think, okay, African-American and Latin-American community of neighborhoods, their interest was sacrificed in the process. But when after reading this fantastic book, Dr. Michael Liu's fantastic book, I realized, okay, at least in Boston, Chinese Chinatown, Chinese community were also victim of those infrastructural building in the 1970s, 1980s, or even now. So then let's turn to the next question. So for the next one, I'm wondering how, I mean, trans-Bostonian community activists made Chinatown more inclusive.
Okay, before I go into that, I just want to mention that probably in all of the Chinatowns that still exist, there were groups fighting against urban renewal in order to save the Chinatowns. But the specific history of, I mean, but I think in Boston it was particularly intense. So basically, there was decades of community struggle that involved a spectrum of tactics and tools. So everything from engagement in electoral politics to gain political power, community master planning, protest politics, community development groups, and other tactics were attempted. So it's the many decades from that time until now. So, but I'm just going to talk about some of the important highlights in a way. So one was the engagement in the 1983 mayoral race in the city. So in this particular mayoral campaign, neighborhoods and groups across the city had become engaged in the mayoral race because urban renewal had been going on in the city for a while, but the neighborhoods had seen very few benefits, but they mainly saw a lot of destruction. Who benefited was the downtown area. So the Chinatown activists supported Mel King, who was the first African American to reach the Boston mayoral final election. And this election was important in many aspects for Chinatown. Because of the course of it, Chinatown began working with many neighborhoods and constituency groups across the city, who probably for the first time realized that the neighborhood was an active and viable community. So the election was also one in which the neighborhoods had revolted against the elites, the established businesses and politicians who supported the redevelopment of the city, but ignored the issues of those living in it. So that both the candidates who had survived into the final were both neighborhood supporters. So despite Mel King losing, an Irish-American candidate who was neighborhood-oriented was elected and became a force for some reforms. So one example, one is Wolf's most well-known reforms was that the new mayor, Ray Flynn, instituted a charge for every square foot of development in large development projects. And the money from these charges would go to community housing and employment. Also, during the Flynn administration, Chinatown developed its first master plan, where the city agreed to limit building heights in Chinatown, and it was finally finished in 1990. However, I think Chinatown also learned about the limits of reforms that were dependent upon continued development. You know, the fees dependent upon that for community housing was dependent upon continued building in the downtown. So what happened was that later, after the passage of the master plan, the Boston Redevelopment Authority continued to waive the guidelines in order to allow continued development of large developments in Chinatown. And there were also many promises about how redevelopment would benefit Chinatown, and that proved to be limited or non-existent. So in the following decades, Chinatown continued to organize protests. And one of the most important was involved a Tufts New England Medical Center garage that was supported by the Redevelopment Authority and the mayor. So this was a year and a half struggle from 1993 to 1994. And in this campaign, Chinatown organizing groups, primarily the Chinese Progressive Association and Asian American Resource Workshop, and progressive service organizations and Chinatown residents had learned to use a lot of different tools, including they brought in legal service lawyers, they developed a media campaign, and they organized protests that sometimes tied up all of downtown by marching to City Hall. So they eventually defeated the garage. But what was important was that through this struggle, China was able to organize a loose alliance of other neighborhoods that were opposed to the Redevelopment Authority. And by winning, it had set a boundary that the medical center would no longer cross. And it also set an example that other neighborhoods hoped to emulate, because it was very, very hard to defeat the Redevelopment Authority. Following this struggle, Chinatown basically pursued a strategy around two components. First, building citywide alliances, and second, building up its power in electoral politics and lobbying. So then in the 21st century, it became a leading neighborhood in citywide alliances around housing, because Chinatown had developed some of the most stable community organizations in the city, like the Chinese Progressive Association. It has been able to support and have influence with then also do its electoral work with city councilors and mayors who have been more supportive of Chinatown issues. So in fact, the current mayor of Boston is a Taiwanese American woman. She's actually the first mayor of color and the first non-Irish and non-white Anglo-Saxon mayor, except for and it was one Italian American mayor that preceded her. So and she's very supportive of preserving the community. Chinatown has also continued to engage in like referendum campaigns for direct reforms. So that's basically, outline of kind of the struggles that it's had in those decades.
Okay, thanks so much for also again. One more time, I want to recommend this session, because Dr. Liu's talk so far is covered chapter 9, chapter 10 with his book. So when I read this book, I think it's interesting, because from my perspective, Chinese person living in Buffalo, the typical Rust Belt city, there's a prevalent prevalent stereotype impression of the Chinese American in general as a silent minority, silent ethnic minority, but that's not true. That's not true, because when we talk about Chinese Americans, especially white American, usually believe, okay, most Chinese American are politically inactive, but it's misleading, as we can learn from the experience of Chinese and Bostonian struggle and the Chinese Bostonian activist collaboration with people with community of other ethnic and cultural background. Trans-American are not, in any sense, are not politically inactive. They are very active, but their activism, their activity had been overshadowed in American, in media, in history textbook for a long time. So then, now let's turn to the last question today. So I'm after reviewing the past and the present of Boston and Chinatown in Boston. Let's talk about its future, especially as you mentioned today, this city, Boston, has the first mayor of Asian heritage. So let's talk about the future of Chinatown and the city.
Well, absolutely. I agree with what you just said. Which is another reason, you know, like I said, I wrote the book. Because, you know, Chinese have contributed in unseen ways in many ways. I mean, you know, there were Chinese soldiers that fought in the Civil War on the Union side. Anyway, I feel like the future of Boston Chinatown is kind of cloudy. The problem is that development entities for local communities such as cities and towns are usually the most powerful forces in the area. They contribute the most to mayors and political candidates, and you know they have a lot of resources, and it's a very complex process. So that even though today, over the decades, people have won the right to have more community hearings and more review of projects, it's very technical and very sustained, and it takes a lot to go through the process. So that there's a big power and resource imbalance in communities versus development. So that's one of the main reasons. So even today, like there are attempts to bring in hotels into Chinatown, as well as and for a while when Airbnbs were popular. They're still popular, but Boston passed a regulation kind of limiting them. But before that legislation, there were 100 places in Boston Chinatown that was available for Airbnb rental, and people were investing in Chinatown to do that kind of business. But on the other hand, so Chinatown is still being squeezed. And in fact, if you stand in the middle of Chinatown and you look in either direction, you look at either you see either highways or you see skyscrapers being built around the community. So the pressure is always there. But on the other hand, I think that from a community infrastructure perspective, Chinatown has an enviable situation in which the community organizations have a popular base, and the activist groups have some influence in City Hall. And so, I mentioned the current mayor and also the previous mayor have been more sympathetic to the Chinatown issues. On the other hand, there are a lot of limitations because they feel like, you know, the regulations favor more development and not less development. So that is one of the big, so that basically, even though the population of Boston Chinatown has remained more or less stable over the last couple of decades, but they've been forced into smaller and smaller parts of land, and they just go up. You know, the buildings, Boston Chinatown used to be primarily three-story row houses, you know, made of brick. Now we have housing projects, you know, that go up, you know, six, seven, eight stories. And so even though the same number of people are in Chinatown, they're compressing to smaller spaces. Like most cities, growing cities, there's a big housing crisis throughout the whole city. And so there's a big question about whether or not the current strategy of just trying to have political influence can solve Chinatown's most important issues, or does something more serious need to happen? So even though things are stable at this point, the other thing that the activists have been able to do is to put those housing projects that are that remain, they've been able to stabilize the rents. A lot of them were subsidized to some government programs, and they've been able to get those extended. So, as I mentioned, at least for the working class people who populate Chinatown, the situation is somewhat stable. But it's unclear to me what is going to happen in the future. So Chinatown, I think, like other people in the city, are trying to experiment with kind of new ideas about how you preserve the community. One example is that the former executive director of Chinese Progressive Association started a community land trust organization. A community land trust organization, what it does is it controls the land in the community. Even though people can own the houses on top of it, it would control the land underneath it. And that would limit developers being able to come in and convert into the housing into luxury housing, which is basically what's been happening all around it. But I think this is an issue that the whole city is struggling with, but it's particularly intense in Chinatown because of its location right against, the downtown business area and the hospital and so on.
Okay, thanks so much for your answer to the last question today. So at the end of our talk, I want to directly talk to our listeners. So first thing, again, as what I always say at the end of the episode, I personally highly recommend this book, Dr. Mario Liu's book, Forever's Travel. It's a fantastic book about the history of Boston, especially in Chinatown, the city. Meanwhile, I very recommend you buy a copy or borrow a copy of this book from the library and read it carefully for one personal reason is that different from some historians, some of my colleagues, I may call them armchair historians. Dr. Liu is academic and activist. So in my personal view, when you're reading some book about social history, it means that you're doing the gender history, women's history, ethnic history, racial history. You had better read those books authored by academic and activist. In the Asian, for example, in the historiography of Asian American historiography, we have some big name who are both historian and activist. Civil rights activist, such as Yuji Ichioka, the founder, the person who put forward the phrase Asian American during Asian American movement. Later on, he became a big name in Asian American history's writings. We have Maynard in Columbia University. She is also a social activist and famous historian. For some reason, I personally highly recommend you read this book. It's because Dr. Liu, he is not only a writer of the history, he is also a participant of history. He is a social activist. So compared to those people, I call them armchair historians, no armchair academics, Dr. Liu's narrative, Dr. Liu's study could provide some insider view of what really happened there without his intense experience in the struggle for social justice, housing justice, all kind of justice in Boston's Chinatown. He cannot bring so much insight. So that's one reason I recommend you read this book. You can know some insider's view, insight's understanding of not just about Boston Chinatown, but also about community activists in the neighborhood. So at the end, I want to repeat the title. If you want to take notes, please take notes. This book, the title of this book is called Forever's Travel. It's about the history of Chinatown in Boston. It's about how Chinese Bostonians struggle for justice in post-war American history and in the first, 21st century today. So it's a fantastic book. So thanks so much for listening to the episode today. Have a good time. Thank you.
Thank you for your kind words.